Talk given Friday, 4th May 1979. It is important that we should constantly ask ourselves, are we really living the religious life? Or is it a case of church on Sundays and the ordinary secular activities and conflicts from Monday to Saturday? It's so very easy to deceive ourselves. Why is it so important to watch ourselves so carefully? Our thought and feeling, speech and action, our whole behavior in life is the sign whether we are being perfectly honest about living religiously, or is it a sham, a pretense? It isn't at all easy to live the religious life. So we have to be extremely mindful all through the day. I know how difficult it is. I am of an age where I've had quite half a century and more of effort, of practice with religious living, the real inner discipline of certain esoteric schools, as they call themselves, and of at least four of the great religions of the world, where the discipline is subtly hidden in the outer forms of the religious teachings. And in all cases, the difficulty is very great. But then, if anything is to be done well, it is difficult to do it well. Can we write a Hamlet or a Lear? Can we produce a Faust or a Divina Commedia or an Iliad or an Odyssey? It's very, very difficult. And howsoever experienced and practiced one may become, one is constantly growing if one is serious and one means to live the best and give the best. So we must constantly examine ourselves, not be on our guard, because that means conflict, psychological conflict with all its ill consequences. Remorse and regret on the one hand, and self-approval on the other hand. Self-approval ends with pride, conceit, then it is very easy to fall into the next pit, and remorse and regret produces guilt conscience, a guilt conscience, and all the ill effects that follow from it. But if we are seriously mindful, that is to say, not necessarily in terms of actual fact, because we do slip away from mindfulness. This is what does happen with all of us. But in terms of the willingness, the earnestness to remain mindful and be watchful, and insofar as our mindfulness shows us, makes us aware that we are not living up to our own deepest vision of the religious life, insofar as we fail to do that, insofar as we don't do it, we are, in the words of Jesus, for instance, hypocrites. It's a sham. So it is important to do this. Now, our behavior and all that goes on inside our own minds, and all that takes place in terms of the manner in which we are observant, completely attentive to the total situation, affects consciousness. Now, we have been talking quite a bit about consciousness for some months. This, especially in connection with this transformation of our mode of awareness of existence from the worldly mode into the purely human, the divine mode, the transcendent mode. And in the transcendent mode, what is completely out is selfness. We have ceased to be self-concerned, self-centered. And with that, so many misconceptions regarding the nature of reality and truth and so forth, all those misconceptions go. Let us once again look into this word consciousness, or if you like, awareness. For us, consciousness means discriminative consciousness. Now, as long as there is discriminative consciousness, there is the separation between the self, I who am conscious of. I, the subject, am looking at that, the object. And that separation involves a looking which is not a perfect cord of communion. The same with our hearing, with our touching, and so forth. It is not a perfect cord of communion. Because discriminative observation invariably brings in our values, our judgments, our criteria, and they are all, each and every one of them, in the worldly mode of consciousness, each and every one of them is tainted with our desires, our ambitions, our pleasure drive, our subtle intellectual hypocrisies, and so forth, the Mephistopheles in us. Now you see, this transformation of consciousness, of awareness, as and when it takes place, culminates in, flowers into pure consciousness. Now, pure consciousness is unconscious. It's completely devoid of contents which are psychical, psychological objects, opaque, like opaque objects, preventing the light from shining through and from within one. It is like this. We have ideals, so our discriminative consciousness is aware of them in terms of description. We have an ideal to be truthful, to be loving, to be honest, and all the rest of it. But the brain, the concretest expression of mind, steps in here and presents forms to that consciousness. So it is a case of my consciousness functioning. This is an obstructed consciousness. And its function being obstructed like that with so many things is not pure consciousness. Therefore, this person called, which one refers to with reference to oneself as I, is not truly loving, actually truthful, perfectly honest, truly observant, completely attentive. We are not that. When there is pure consciousness, then the brain never knows what is going on, what is happening. It knows only the impressions made upon our organism, our whole organism, through the functioning of the senses, as so many particular uprisings of different types of limited consciousness. Sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, touch consciousness, and the consciousness, that inner process when thought just goes on playing, staging its drama on the stage of our lives, which we commonly call thinking, which we commonly call daydreaming, and in our sleep it is the dreaming sleep. Now, if there is pure consciousness functioning freely, then all your thinking, feeling, speaking, and action is actually loving, truthful, unself-indulging, and so forth, without your knowing it. It just is your natural condition. And all these qualities which we name and can analyze and so forth and observe as outside ourselves, which we want to acquire, all these qualities function in perfection in any and every situation that one finds oneself in their own proper way. But you, the person, are unaware of it. If someone came and said to you, you are really goodness itself, perfection itself, wholeness, truthfulness, you're the embodiment of love, you're the embodiment of wisdom, you'd be quite taken aback. What are you talking about? Now that is the meaning of the word consciousness as presented in the Upanishads. It was first presented there. This identification of the Absolute, of Brahman, of Atma, of the Supreme, whatever you like, in its ultimate verbal statement is declared to be identical with pure or absolute consciousness. Now you see, the meaning of consciousness in the religious sense. Now, in this sense, the word consciousness and the associated word omniscience has been ascribed in the theologies and in the teachings, the great scriptures of the world, to the ultimate God, to the unborn, unbecome, unmade, which is only another way of saying the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. You see, that is to use Buddhistic terms. And Buddhism, as far as I'm aware, is the only religion which presents this particular form, which is psychologically more sound than all the positive assertions. It is the not become, the not made, the not born. Because whatsoever is born must of necessity become an entity, and as an entity it is not the absolute, the infinite. You see, it is not made. Whatever is made is a separate something put together. And to make a separate something means, in actual fact, to split the unity of the universe, or attempt to split it. Now, if the meaning of the word God, or of Ramazda, or Allah, or Brahman, or Atma, if it is really understood, and the intellect can go extraordinarily far, if you have that kind of nous, that power of profound perception, if it can go sufficiently far, we'll realize the true meaning of consciousness in this absolute sense, pure consciousness. It implies, therefore, that you, the individual, have lived the holy life to perfection and continue living it. It is not a case of attaining a goal, therefore. Because as long as you live, you have to be thus. And then you're the perfect human. You know, in the New Testament, it's very remarkably well put, and the manhood is taken up, was taken up into the Godhead. Now those people who wrote that first and taught that first were people who were very close to him who had realized. That is to say, he who had become grown into the sinless one, the totally sinless one, that is, the one who did not split up or try to split up the unity of the universe. The manhood means fundamentally the mindhood. The mind in its imperfect, stained state cannot help, cannot avoid splitting things up. But it is through that splitting up and undergoing the struggles, the conflicts, the unhappinesses, the frustrations, as well as the temporary only, elations and successes and so forth. It is only by going through that and being earnest about discovering the meaning of it all, that you can really begin to see light. Begin to see light. This word consciousness, or if you like to use the word awareness, this word consciousness has an extraordinarily profound meaning. And it is that kind of consciousness which functions through the perfected Holy One. The Whole One is one who is a separate being on the planet, living on the planet, by virtue of the fact that he is an organism which is limited in terms of matter, space, that is to say, his extent, how big he is or how small he is, and time. You see, space, time, matter all come into existence simultaneously with that Big Bang which produces each one of us, just as it produces an entire cosmos. Now, this, the finite, the mortal, that which is not eternal, becomes so pure, so complete, so fulfilled thereby, without that person being conscious of this, because this discriminative consciousness which separates one from the rest of the world is at work then, you see. This person, although finite and mortal, is the focus through which the energy of transcendence, the energy of transcendence flows freely into and out of him. Now, this is pure consciousness. And pure consciousness does not belong to anybody at all. There is no such thing in actuality as my consciousness. There is my psychical functioning in terms of thought and feeling and so forth, which is the distorted expression of the universal consciousness, the spoilt expression of the universal consciousness. Just as we can't legitimately talk of my mind as something which I possess. Mind is a universal energy, as we have seen again and again through our meetings. But today, and at our last meeting too, I talked about consciousness, you may remember. I'm trying to suggest a way of understanding consciousness so that one realizes the tremendous importance of the external manifestations of consciousness, both in its restricted, conditioned state, and also in its pure state. Now, what we commonly call my mind has been presented, of course, in all the religious teachings, as the tainted mind. That is one of the reasons why somehow it just happened. It took several years to happen. The understanding sort of welled up, which made me separate the two words, psyche and mind. And the reason, one of the reasons for that is this. In 1963, when I met the Dalai Lama and four wonderful afternoons, each time for about 4 to 4.5 hours, he spoke to me about the Mahayana presentation of mind, of the void, of emptiness and so forth. And he emphasized that whilst the body is the product of a sperm and an ovum, material stuff, the mind is something different. But he couldn't sort of present it properly. He talked of the essence of mind. And he said that the essence of mind in you is that which carries over the karmic consequences of all your thought, feeling and action, of thought, speech and action. Now you know, this, and he said that there is no relationship between mind and the material body. Now you see, we know that this is untrue. Because when he was talking of mind, he was definitely also talking of and including all our, what we commonly call our mental processes, our thoughts and our feelings. We call them and our moods and, you know, everything which is special to us. And we know beyond a shadow of a doubt nowadays that the bodily structure, the brain, the nervous system, the activity of the ductless glands, the nature of the bloodstream and everything has a tremendous influence. In fact, it is a blueprint from the time the fertilized ovum comes into being of the kind of mental functioning that that person is likely to display throughout his life. See? And this was a problem from 1963 onwards, particularly. I had been thinking about this from the 1940s, in fact, undergoing awful distress over so many of these doctrines which seemed to me really badly presented. I have never denied the underlying truth of any of these teachings, but they have been badly presented in terms of concepts and words. And from 1963 onwards, I looked into this very carefully. Here is the actual fact which we know, that the bodily structure has a very powerful determining influence upon the processes. And then I wondered why it was that the word psyche has come into prominence more and more only in our day and age. The psychologists, modern psychologists, just like the old psychologists, Aristotle, Plato, and the Kannada, and various others in India, and so forth, they were all psychologists in their way. But they never made this distinction clear. On the one hand, they taught mind is the creative power which brings forth the universe. And, of course, the the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus are really wonderful in that respect. You'll get a great deal of help if you study that somewhat carefully. It came to me that it would be useful to confine the word psyche to mind as pictured through our own psychical processes. Now, since the psyche is rooted in the material body, the brain and nervous system, and particularly the ductless glands and their activities, you see, since the psyche is rooted in that, our mental functioning is, our psychical functioning is actually one's own. It is legitimate, therefore, to talk of my psyche. But if mind is this universal something, and mind, as well as consciousness, in the old religious scriptures, has been presented as without characteristics. Without characteristics. Without a beginning and an ending. And all the same, accessible everywhere, throughout the universe, and shining. In the Buddhist form, you get vijnanam, which of course by itself means discriminative consciousness, anidassanam, anantam, sabbato, pabham, in the Pali. You see, mind, which is infinite, immortal, anantam, without end, therefore implying without beginning, therefore outside the realm of time, without characteristics, therefore outside the realm of form, substance, matter, you see, everywhere shining. Shining, they use the words pahang or pabham. One means, sabbato means everywhere. One means everywhere shining or everywhere accessible. That means infinite, creative. And creation is a mystery. We don't know, certainly I don't know, how creation takes place. All I can be sensitive to, in a tiny way have become sensitive to, is this fact, that this primordial creative energy, which in its own absolute condition is in a state of vibrant quiescence. You get that utter peace, that bliss of God, where there is no disturbance whatsoever. See, the quiescence. But it is not a static thing, nor is it a dynamic thing, that is a movement through space and time. Therefore, the whole question of the whole fact of eternity and immortality are bound up in that vibrant quiescence. And this primordial energy, when it manifests, when it acts in terms of one of its archetypal forms, which we call mind, brings forth shape by means of self-constriction. This idea of self-constriction, I don't know where it originally comes from, it's not original to me by any means, brings forth the cosmos, and the whole business of evolution and so on takes place. Now, we as we are, and with our modern knowledge and so forth, think of life principally in biological terms, and then analogically we speak of our mental life, our psychological life, our spiritual life, and we call it everlasting. Now that precisely is the error, isn't it? Everlasting means enduring, holding on. You can't hold on unless you separate and divide. You've got to hold on to something, you see. Everlasting through all time. Is that more confusing and confusion more confounded, or does that help at all? So now, mind in its functioning first brings that into being. But this which is limited, which is confined, which is sorrowful, which is painful, which is pleasant, all these manifestations, the entire manifested universe is completely subsumed in the unmanifest. And the Upanishads have these extraordinary statements: beyond being and non-being, you see, beyond the manifest and the unmanifest, beyond the perishable and the imperishable. So you see, it's very difficult to get a meaning to that word absolute. All this is relative. The unmanifest, the immeasurable, is also relative. We talk of the timeless and time. The timeless is not the absolute. Eternity is the absolute, as far as I can put it in terms of words. So, I have always admitted that I arbitrarily made this distinction between psyche and mind. Mind is this universal something that pervades all of us. It has no characteristics, it has no substance. It is the void in its pure sense. And what is it void of, particularly? It is void of, to use the Buddhist presentation, it is void of all dukkha. And the fundamental meaning of dukkha is not suffering and sorrow and unsatisfactoriness and all those paltry words in our sense of the word, meanings of those words. It is void of being far from, being extruded out of, being an excrescence of, something thrown away, the infinite. That is the fundamental meaning of dukkha. Stick to that. If you really want to understand religious teachings, start with the absolute and find yourself, what shall I say, enthroned in the absolute. You won't find yourself enthroned, you will be enthroned in the absolute. You won't know it, but the moment the brain starts knowing it, then Mephistopheles is once again at it, having a good time. You might say, good gracious me, how on earth does all this super ethereal philosophizing help us? It is the one thing that will help you. For one thing, you will discover the utter futility of trying to grasp the universe through conceptual activity, through verbal activity. And when you really see that, you have become conscious of it in the profound, the true meaning of the word conscious, not the discriminative consciousness meaning. When you become conscious of it in that way, what happens to you, the psychophysical person? You become quiet. You just let be. In the real sense, especially up here, this terrible turmoil which goes on in the brain all the time. This churning up of thought, especially through the medium of language and also of the sense impressions, sights, sounds, tastes, smells, and all the rest of the stuff. You'll become quiet. And in that state of natural, spontaneous quietude, this complete unity, this relationship of yourself, the microcosmos, in relationship with the vibrant quiescence, the primordial creative energy, is perfect, is right. The greatest of the mystics, the greatest of the religious teachers in perfect unity, in perfect communion, never wasted words upon trying to describe this. Those who had artistic gift, they indeed tried to describe it, and in some cases wonderfully well. But eschew all that. Leave it aside. That's not important. Be this. And our one instrument of salvation, so to say, which we have, is to be mindful like this. This mindfulness of our whole living process, our behavior, our thinking, feeling, speaking, and doing, affects consciousness, the universal consciousness, as it is within us. And consciousness affects in its turn, is the most powerful influence upon all our outward manifestation, because that is the supreme creative energy. It'll take science and psychologists a few centuries yet before they really are able to begin to understand these things. But this way you'll find that you cannot help but live religiously. Then pure consciousness is at work. When it happens because you can't help it, it just happens, and you don't evaluate it, you don't try to grasp it, you don't try to produce it. It just happens.